Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. At least 20 dead in Taliban suicide bombing. A powerful suicide blast targeting a major police facility in the Afghan capital has killed at least 20 police officers and wounded 29 other people. The head of Kabul's crime investigation department said security guards identified the suspected bomber as he moved toward the Afghan National Civil Order Police headquarters and tried to stop him when he blew himself up. The Taliban claimed responsibility. UN Envoy Stefan de Mistura struggled on Monday to keep peace talks on track in Geneva, where Syrian government and opposition representatives are present but not yet fully involved in indirect negotiations. UN officials said talks that had been scheduled between the UN envoy and the Syrian government delegation for midday Monday were postponed. A spokesman for the main opposition group said Monday he'd received a positive response from Mr. de Mistura on their demands to halt airstrikes and allow the flow of humanitarian aid to rebel-held areas. But the opposition said escalating violence could hinder the already fragile process. Farah Atassi is a member of the Saudi-backed Syrian opposition delegation.
This actually is an insult for the United Nations. It's an insult for all the efforts. The regime, what they're doing, is blowing off all these international efforts, really, to push for a serious negotiation or to push for the political transition. We can't go on like this under the bombing. To be honestly, there is no national Syrian can go and start negotiate with a regime that killing his own people, that bombing his people, that hitting 52 barrel in less than 1 hour. This is unprecedented.
The UN envoy was scheduled to meet with the opposition later on Monday. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization has convened a meeting of researchers and health officials to determine whether the Zika virus should be declared a global health emergency. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. The WHO predicts the virus, which may be linked to neurological disorders in babies, could infect as many as 4 million people in the Americas this year.
No firm link has been established between the Zika virus and microcephaly, a neurological disorder in babies who are born with abnormally small heads. World Health Organization spokesman Gregory Hartl tells VOA experts are not ruling out anything, but the surge in the number of microcephaly cases and the Zika virus may just be coincidental in terms of time and place.
So one of the curiosities is why we have so many neurological cases in, say, the northeast of Brazil, but we haven't had it in other places.
Zika gets its name from a forest in Uganda where the virus was first identified in 1947. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nearly 4,000 suspected cases of microcephaly have occurred in Brazil since October, compared with 150 similar cases in 2014. Human rights group Amnesty International has strongly criticized the reinstatement of a Nigerian army commander who it says is implicated in war crimes during the country's battle with Islamist Boko Haram militants. The Nigerian government has denied the accusation, Henry Ridgewell reports.
In one of the most disturbing allegations, Amnesty International says the Nigerian military executed more than 640 prisoners who briefly escaped during an attack by Boko Haram on a detention center in Giwa in March 2014. Daniel Eyre from Amnesty says the man in command of operations that day was Major General Ahmadu Mohamed.
He was also in charge of that military detention facility, and suspects in that facility died on an almost daily basis as a result of horrific conditions. They were tortured, starved, and even died of disease in that facility.
Major General Ahmadu Mohamed was retired in 2014 for unrelated reasons. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A spokesperson for the Nigerian Ministry of Defense said Amnesty's claims remain allegations unless they are proven beyond any reasonable doubt. Amnesty, however, says the evidence is absolutely clear. Uganda says it arrested a military general who opposes the country's longtime president, Yoweri Museveni, because he broke laws barring officers from supporting candidates in an election. Government spokesman said General David Sejusa was actively engaged in supporting partisan politics. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Suspected Boko Haram fighters attacked a village in Nigeria's volatile northeast over the weekend, burning huts and detonating a suicide bomb. An emergency services spokesman says around 40 people are dead.
That's Chris Stein reporting from Lagos. Details next.
Also, the African Union summit concluded yesterday with delegates deciding not to send peacekeeping troops to troubled Burundi. And the UN human rights chief says he is alarmed by the deepening crisis in Burundi and warns actions must be taken.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, suspected Boko Haram fighters attacked a village in Nigeria's volatile northeast over the weekend, burning huts and detonating a suicide bomb. An emergency services spokesman says around 40 people are dead. Other reports put the death toll at more than double that number. Chris Stein has more from Lagos.
The attack started late Saturday when fighters stormed Dilori, a village on the outskirts of the Borno state capital, Maiduguri. Northeastern coordinator for the National Emergency Management Agency, Alhaji Muhammad Kanar, says villagers fled as the fighters approached.
They scared the people and they rushed outside. They run out of the village, almost all of them, and set the whole village at their place.
The villagers regrouped, thinking they were safe. That is when the suicide bomber struck.
The suicide bomber detonated his explosive, thereby killed so many people in there.
Kanar says about 40 people were killed in the attack. He could not say how many were wounded. The village of Dilori shares a name with a nearby camp for some 18,000 people displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. The insurgents have forced more than 2.2 million Nigerians from their homes and killed about 20,000 people in their six-year quest to impose strict Islamic law. Nigeria's government late last year said they had defeated the group, but acknowledged the militants still had the capability to carry out attacks on civilians. Kanar says no militants were able to enter the displaced persons camp.
We were so lucky, even they were not inside the camp. It would have caused a lot of more havoc than that.
Kanar says emergency services are working to shelter the newly displaced people from Dilori. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The Africa Union summit ended Sunday with delegates deciding not to send peacekeeping troops to troubled Burundi. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has warned that deployment of such troops would be treated as an invasion. From Nairobi, Jill Craig reports the African Union now plans to send a delegation to Burundi for more talks.
At the African Union's 26th summit in Addis Ababa, Burundi took center stage. During his opening remarks, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged action.
In Burundi, I welcome your proposal to deploy human rights observers and to establish a prevention and protection mission. This crisis requires the most serious and urgent commitment from all of us.
But the African Union's Commissioner for Peace and Security, Smael Shergi, announced Sunday the bloc would not deploy a proposed 5,000 peacekeeping troops to Burundi. Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza, who did not attend the summit, and his government have warned deploying the troops would be viewed as an invasion of the country's territory. Instead, the African Union will send a high-level delegation to Bujumbura to discuss possible deployment of peacekeepers. The mission's mandate would include the protection of civilians, disarmament of militia, seizure of illegal arms, and protection of borders. Kenya's School of Law Director PLO Lumumba is displeased with this action, saying the African Union backtracked on a decision purely for political reasons.
Because it is in many ways a statement to the rulers of Burundi that you can do what you want and we will look the other way. It is a sad thing that has happened in Addis Ababa.
The exiled leader of the Opposition Front for Democracy in Burundi, Jean Minani, agrees with Lumumba. He said Africa and the international community are turning their backs on Burundi's people. He said he believes other African leaders, some of whom he calls dictators, worry a peacekeeping force in Burundi may pave the way for similar forces coming into their own countries. Lumumba agrees with that sentiment.
So there is a sense in which they are merely protecting their skin and they don't care about the people of Africa at all.
The African Union also presented its new chairperson, Chad President Idriss Deby, who takes over from outgoing chair Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe. The new chairman urged dialogue throughout the continent.
C'est le cas pour le Burundi, le Soudan du Sud.
He says, in the cases of Burundi and South Sudan, the African Union must pursue its efforts so that we can find a way to peace very quietly, and this depends immediately on ending violence. We cannot allow thousands to die due to violence. Additionally, the African Union expressed its appreciation for those it called the African heroes against Ebola, officially closing its mission to West Africa, where it had sent 855 health workers. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
UN Human Rights Chief Zayed Raad al-Hussein says he is alarmed by the deepening crisis in Burundi. He warns that action must be taken to stop the country's spiraling descent toward a possible bloodbath. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad al-Hussein expressed regret Monday at the African Union's decision not to send a peacekeeping force of 5,000 to Burundi. He says the AU plan has been placed in the freezer for the time being while further negotiations with Burundian authorities take place.
We remain deeply concerned about the trajectories and the vectors that still point to the deepening of the crisis. And of course, we are very fearful of a precipitous event that may trigger a slide into the abyss.
The United Nations reports more than 400 people have been killed and around 3,500 arrested since President Pierre Nkurunziza declared he would run for a third term at the end of April. It says more than 220,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries. Amnesty International's report of several mass graves near the capital Bujumbura is adding to growing concerns of a Rwandan-style genocidal war breaking out in Burundi. Ethnic Hutu radicals killed an estimated 800,000 people, most of them Tutsis, in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. High Commissioner Zaid tells VOA the crisis in Burundi is one of the most depressing parts of the international agenda. He says international efforts to stop the country's turmoil are not working.
Nothing seemed to suffice in terms of halting this descent. And we understand from other conflicts, Syria is a classic example, that the longer you leave it, the more difficult it is to then find a way of putting it back together again.
Zaid says he hopes continued international focus on Burundi will have a positive effect. He notes a group of UN independent experts investigating abuse in that country will soon issue a report on its findings. On another issue, the High Commissioner strongly condemns the sexual abuse and exploitation of children by United Nations peacekeeping and civilian forces in Central African Republic. He calls this victimization of young children odious and worthy of the utmost contempt. He is urging troop-contributing countries to investigate and swiftly prosecute those suspected of committing such heinous crimes. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A study on the effects of exposure to extreme violence has just been released in Nairobi, Kenya. The study on post-traumatic stress disorder in journalists finds it may manifest itself in depression and anxiety. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Nairobi.
The report's author, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Toronto, noted that traumatic events, even as far back as 10 years, continue to affect journalists.
It's the first study that's been completed on this continent, and so Kenya is the first country that has been able to provide some data on the psychological well-being of journalists. But even more importantly, the data show that there are some journalists who still suffer significant difficulties with post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety.
The study, with its main objective focused on the mental health of Kenyan journalists exposed to extreme violence, focused on the post-election violence of 2007 and the deadly 2013 Westgate Mall attack. 90 Kenyan journalists were interviewed from two of the country's leading media houses. Juma Namlolo, a news editor at the Nation Media Group, has been a journalist for more than 20 years. He was in charge of teams dispatched to cover both events, and according to him, the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder are largely ignored by the media houses and journalists themselves.
That time, I was among the reporters who were sent to almost all these places, considering that coming from coast, I was not aligned to either of the two tribes that were antagonists in that post-election result conflict. Therefore, I had to move around places, mortuaries, and every other places, and it was really bad for me.
Experts say Kenya lacks capacity to handle cases of post-traumatic stress disorder. Lydia Maina, a psychologist from St. Paul's University in Limuru, underscores the need for counseling for journalists exposed to traumatic events.
The organization for which the journalist is working for could come up with employee assistance programs, which would be helpful. The other thing is disaster preparedness. They could come up with a program that will take care of the journalists. And this is not only after the crisis, but even before the crisis. A good example is the critical incident stress management. It's a good program because it prepares people before the incident happens, and it also takes care of them after the incident has happened.
The data, the first of their kind from an African country, replicate findings over a decade old from Western media, namely that journalists asked to cover life-threatening events may develop significant symptoms of emotional difficulties and fail to receive therapy for them. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Suspected Boko Haram fighters attacked a village in Nigeria's volatile northeast, burning huts and detonating a suicide bomb. The African Union summit concluded Sunday with delegates deciding not to send peacekeeping troops to troubled Burundi. And the UN human rights chief says he is alarmed by the deepening crisis in Burundi and warns action must be taken. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The U.S. Agency for International Development has announced an additional $97 million in drought aid for Ethiopia. That brings U.S. assistance to Ethiopia over the last 4 months to over $500 million. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon visited the region yesterday and asked donors for $1.4 billion in aid for the nation's drought victims.
Germany's interior minister is meeting today with Afghan officials to discuss ways to reduce the number of migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe. More than 150,000 refugees from Afghanistan entered Germany to claim political asylum in 2015. That's the second largest flow number after Syrians. The German official urged Afghans to stay home and rebuild their country. Also, UN Human Rights Agency Chief Zaid Raad Al Hussein says he is deeply disturbed by the rhetoric of German politicians. He says they are fostering stigma against migrants and refugees. The stigma arose after a mob in Cologne was alleged to have committed rape and theft during a New Year's Eve celebration. The human rights chief urged an immediate investigation of the charges. Several of the suspects have been identified as Germans or others who were not migrants.
The World Health Organization is meeting today in an emergency session to debate the threat posed by the Zika virus. The virus is spreading rapidly through the Americas and may be linked to a birth defect that causes abnormally small heads in infants. The WHO will decide whether the virus should be declared a public health emergency. The UN agency is moving quickly in contrast to its slow response to the West Africa Ebola outbreak. Zika is spread by mosquitoes, and the WHO warns there may be as many as 4 million cases in the Americas this year. And the World Health Organization is calling on governments to give a restricted rating to movies that portray tobacco use. The WHO wants to use the rating system to prevent children and adolescents from starting to smoke cigarettes and use other forms of tobacco. The agency's Smoke-Free Movies report claims that movies showing use of tobacco products have enticed millions of young people worldwide to start smoking. Dr. Armando Peruga is program manager of WHO's Tobacco-Free Initiative. He explains why tighter restrictions on the use of tobacco products in movies is needed worldwide.
Studies have shown consistently that smoking scenes have great influence in getting young people that do not smoke yet into smoking. Studies in the United States, for example, indicate that about 37% of young people starting smoking is due to the influence of smoking in films, in movies, as well as in other entertainment products. So, a very important problem.
So the WHO then is calling on governments to rate smoking scenes. How will this be done?
WHO is calling on governments to use their capacity. Different films can be recommended to be viewed for certain ages. And in the case of tobacco, we recommend that these films be classified for people 18 and over. And what in the United States is called an R movie. This is more self-regulatory action of the industry, and we are calling on them to do the same thing. It's not the only thing we are trying to do. There's another three things that we would like the movie industry to do. Is one is that they certify that they have not received anything in exchange for portraying smoking in movies. That is just the creative choice of the director or the producer. Also, that no brands be shown, as you can show some products but not brands. And in the last instance, that advertising or counter-advertising indicating that the movie contains smoking scenes and that smoking is dangerous for your health be applied.
So this would apply to countries around the world, not in any particular region?
No, to all countries, yes.
So far, what has been the response to this call?
There's been countries that have begun to implement some of these measures. Perhaps the two that are furthest along are India and China. India has been a leader in putting some advertising of the dangers of tobacco at the beginning of the movie or TV, soap opera, or whatever it is. And whenever a tobacco scene appears, there's a static message at the bottom of the screen indicating that tobacco is dangerous to your health. China has basically applied rules to avoid, for example, the showing of minors smoking or the showing of smoking where the law prohibits smoking. For example, if you cannot smoke in bars and restaurants, which is the case, for example, in Beijing, then movies should not portray as normal such use of tobacco. And as you can see, there's many more things to be done. Right now, no country has implemented the rating system that we are proposing, and we hope that this call will encourage governments and the movie industry to do so.
Do you anticipate any backlash from the tobacco industry?
Well, I guess, but we don't care. This is a matter of protecting young people and protecting health, and the tobacco industry at heart has just the opposite purpose. So there's only a contradiction in essence between the purpose of such industry and the purpose of protection of health.
That was Dr. Armando Peruga, program manager of WHO's Tobacco-Free Initiative. He spoke with me from Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 26 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the African Union Summit Year of Human Rights with a particular focus on women's rights. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC as they discuss human rights. That's next time on VOA Africa.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses Zika virus. What is it? Who is at risk? How to prevent and treat it? Understanding Zika virus and the current outbreak. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC. Right here on VOA Africa.
What's going on? What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah. Now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally. Oh,
yeah. I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is @UpfrontAfrica. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Suspected Boko Haram fighters attacked a village in Nigeria's volatile northeast, burning huts and detonating a suicide bomb. The African Union summit concluded yesterday with delegates deciding not to send peacekeeping troops to the troubled Burundi. And the UN human rights chief says he is alarmed by the deepening crisis in Burundi and warns actions must be taken. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature reports, affordable health insurance for low-income earners in Kenya. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's now time for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have some tennis kudos this evening.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Novak Djokovic and Angelique Kerber, who won Australian Open tennis singles titles over the weekend in Melbourne. Ladies first, the 28-year-old Kerber lifted her first Grand Slam trophy. She upset defending champion Serena Williams in the final 6-4, 3-6, and 6-4. Kerber is the first German to win a major title since Steffi Graf at the 1999 French Open. Her best previous Grand Slam performance was making it to the semifinals at the 2011 U.S. Open and 2012 Wimbledon tournaments. Kerber talks about her feelings after beating Serena.
When I won the match point, I had so many emotions and, of course, positive things. So getting in my mind that I making history as well in Germany and everybody is supporting me. So it was just incredible feeling what I will never forget.
Angelique Kerber's road to the trophy in Australia was not smoothly paved. In her opening match against Misaki Doi, she saved a match point in the second set and eventually pulled out a three-set victory over her Japanese opponent. Kerber describes her Grand Slam triumph in Australia as the highlight of her career.
You know, the best moments, I had the best 2 weeks in my life, and the best moment of my career last night when I won the match point and really take the Grand Slam. That was always my dream, and my dream came true. When I was a kid, I was always dreaming about this, to win one day a Grand Slam. And I think I had a really crazy week with the first round where I was match point down, but yeah, the best weeks of my life.
Meanwhile, defending champion and world number one Novak Djokovic beat Andy Murray in straight sets to equal Roy Emerson's record of 6 Australian Open titles. The final score from Melbourne, 6-1, 7-5, and 7-6. The Serbian star has won the last 3 Grand Slam titles and 4 of the last 5 to lift his career total to 11. That ties him with Rod Laver and Bjorn Borg for 5th place on the all-time list. Djokovic says there's no doubt that he's playing the best tennis of his life in the last 15 months. For his part, Andy Murray lost for a 5th time in an Australian Open final. Immediately after losing to Djokovic, he rushed to the airport to catch a flight back to Britain to reunite with his pregnant wife, Kim. She's due to have their first child soon. South African golfer Brandon Grace won the Commercial Bank Qatar Masters Tournament in the Middle East over the weekend, becoming the first player to successfully defend the title. The 27-year-old South African closed with a 69 in windy conditions and finished the competition at 14 under par, 274. Reporter Nick Dye caught up with him after his victory and asked him, Brandon, how does it feel to be champion again?
Yeah, it was great. You know, obviously, to win is tough, but to defend is even tougher. We all know that, but it was great. You know, I played some really good golf, and it paid off at the end. And, you know, now I know what it takes to defend a title. But, you know, this is a special one. This is, you know, one that really put me on the map last year. I said it before, I'll say it again. And, you know, just now winning it twice is just extra special.
Elaborate on what it does take to defend a title, because I guess your expectations when you come into a week are a little bit different to usual.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously this week is a little bit calmer. With a Wednesday start, you know, there's not that much time to make a fuss about everything. But it's still tough. I mean, but I think the one thing that really worked out well was the weather. You know, I've played well in tough conditions. I like tough conditions. And it was one of those ones where you just have to stay patient and let it happen. And I think that's what I did really well this week. You know, I never forced things. I got a little bit greedy towards the back of the front nine, just started going after putts a little bit. But the clutch putting, the putts coming back was on top form today. And I think that was a big thing that saved me.
We mentioned on the third day that essentially you were relatively quiet for the first 2 days, but you moved at just the right time, didn't you?
Exactly. You know, it was the same as last week. You know, if you look at Ricky, you know, he was very quiet the first 2 days and then got in the groove and got it going. I knew the weekend's going to be tough. It was really just grinding it out and try to put a number up there and give yourself a chance of winning it. And you know, 3 under, I didn't think that was going to be enough, but I'm glad it's enough. You know, I didn't really have anything else or anything more that I could have added to that.
You have put a smiling face on just about every finish that you've had recently, because on reflection they're all good. Was it becoming just that little bit frustration that you couldn't quite get over the line?
Well, I think I knew what I was doing wrong. You know, I was pushing, I wasn't staying patient, and you know, it happens when you really want that win under the belt, or that next win to strike, get over that next hurdle. And you know, this week was a little bit different. You know, I was really calm the whole week, and like I said, you know, I didn't really push for the things. I made it happen, and the patience was there. And you know, the patience the last 2 days was really big key, and I think that's why I came out on top.
It's nudged you even closer to the world's top 10, and it sets up a great 2016, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly. You know, that's been a long time life goal, and you know, it's been close. And I'm very close now, but you know, like I said before, I just need to keep working and let the clubs do the talking, and hopefully I can be in there soon and, you know, then set a new goal.
No real time to celebrate. On to Dubai.
That's
in great
it.
Form.
Yeah, it happens. But that's our life. But, you know, I'll go there with a smile on the face.
Keep smiling, Brandon. That South African golfer, Brandon Grace, got a smile on his face. Brandon won the Commercial Bank Cotter Masters tournament over the weekend. And Brandon was talking with reporter Nick Dye at the Doha Golf Club in Qatar. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
Voice of America!
In African football, the field is now set for the semifinals at the African Nations Championship Tournament in Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this competition is not to be confused with the Africa Cup of Nations. The African Nations Championship, also called CHAN, is for home-based players in Africa, while in the Africa Cup of Nations, European-based African players are eligible to participate. In the first semifinal Wednesday, the 2009 CHAN champion, the Democratic Republic of Congo, will go against Guinea in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. And in the second semifinal on Thursday, Mali will meet Ivory Coast, also in Kigali. You might say the feathers were flying on Sunday when the Eagles of Mali went up against the Carthage Eagles of Tunisia in Kigali. The Malians rallied to advance to the Final Four, as we hear now from Mark Ouma.
Mali edged Tunisia 2-1 in the Orange African Nations Championship quarterfinals at the Amahoro National Stadium in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Guinea pipped Zambia 5-4 in a post-match penalty shootout after a 0-0 deadlock in open play at the Umganda Stadium in Gishenyi, some 160 kilometers northwest of the capital, Kigali. Early on Saturday, Ivory Coast required extra time before they subdued Cameroon 3-0 at the Huye Stadium in Butare, some 140 kilometers south of Kigali, and the Democratic Republic of Congo pipped Rwanda 2-1 in extra time at the Amahoro National Stadium.
The Voice of America. Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
I encourage our VOA listeners with internet access to check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. The address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny. Once again, that address, facebook.com/VOA Sunny. You'll see photos and videos, and you can post your comments. So check out the Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page.
Voice of America!
And if you check out my Facebook page today, Monday, you'll see a couple of nice photos of basketball great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar with his old college coach, John Wooden. My post is captioned, "We all need good mentors." One of Kareem's was Wooden, the Hall of Fame coach who died in 2010 at age 99. Kareem has credited Wooden with helping him develop not just as a basketball player, but as a man. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the National Basketball Association's all-time leading scorer. In NBA action Sunday, the defending champion Golden State Warriors won their seventh consecutive game, beating the host New York Knicks 116-95. The Knicks held the Warriors to a season-low 18 points in the first quarter, but the Warriors woke up with Klay Thompson scoring 17 of his 34 points in the second quarter. Golden State has 44 victories and only 4 defeats this season. In the northwestern U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, the Portland Trailblazers won their fourth straight game, beating the Minnesota Timberwolves 96-93. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a new generation of ethical farmers rising in South Africa. And next, affordable health insurance for low-income earners in Kenya. But first, some music. It is Daddy Lumba of Ghana with Tiwini.
Jimmy, Tubal Jimmy, Tubal Jimmy.
Daddy Lumba of Ghana with Tuni.
In South Africa, a new generation of farmers is rising. They're committed to producing high-quality food using only natural ingredients. Many of these new ethical farmers are women. At the heart of this movement is demand from consumers for healthy food that isn't mass-produced with the help of chemicals and other artificial agents. In the first part of a series on South Africa's new wave of ethical farmers, Darren Taylor reports on a producer who wins praise for raising excellent chickens.
Fresh spring water nourishes New Harmony Farm north of Johannesburg in the shadow of the Magaliesberg Mountains. Farmer Ruth Mulroy says when she bought the land almost 6 years ago, it was filthy with scrap metal and overgrown with weeds. Now it's producing some of the best chicken in South Africa.
And I've just learned more and more as to what people shouldn't be doing. I know what I don't like, and I know what I do like, and I want to be ethically sound. I want my chickens to grow up as naturally as possible, to eat a natural diet as possible.
Mulroy says chickens have fascinated her since she was a child.
Gawk, 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 all the time. They're talking to each other. There's an interaction going on all the time. It's the communicating of I'm wanting to lay an egg, or with all the cackling when I've laid an egg. All of those, to me, are incredibly peaceful, natural sounds. I love them. I've always been a chicken lady. My nickname is Chicken Lady.
Mulroy describes her chicken as naturally grown. In contrast to factory-farmed birds locked in cages their entire lives and overfed to bulk them up for slaughter, she says her birds live happily.
They don't live under artificial light. They've got to go to bed and sleep with the sunset, and they can get up with the sunrise. They get exposed to the outdoors as quickly as they possibly can. All those noises they're making, they're saying, we want to lay eggs, we want to lay eggs.
Mulroy ensures her 600 chickens are clean and healthy. Inside her barns, there's no pungent stink of chicken feces mixed with chemical cleaning agents. The farmer says this is because she lines the floors with sunflower husk.
It dries out the feces. There's no buildup of wet feces. The houses stay clean, they stay dry, free of flies. We put it into their food as well, so it keeps them clean, so we don't have a problem with worms, internal parasites.
Chickens caged in their thousands on commercial farms are often surprisingly quiet, but New Harmony Farm chickens are very noisy.
They're active, they're running around, they all paw out in the morning, run around catching insects, grubbing around the place.
Mulroy doesn't feed her chickens artificial growth stimulants and fish meal. Crucially, says the farmer, they eat natural food.
5 different indigenous grasses that I'm planting, but then barley in the wintertime, spinach, rape, kale, all are extra feed for the chickens that's planted that they get to eat off the land.
She says her chickens taste so good because of their diet and because they roam the land, so they're not fat. Also, their meat is denser because there's no water injected into it to increase the weight sold to make more money.
The meat is a lot darker, so it's not pale, pale. It's a good old taste of chicken again. Chicken these days has got no taste to it. The youth of today, when they eat chicken, it's bland and tasteless. When they start to eat my chicken, they say, oh no, it tastes too much like chicken, because they're not used to chicken.
Nevertheless, Mulroy's chicken is much in demand in Johannesburg. She supplies delis and restaurants specializing in high-quality fresh produce. One such place is the service station. Here, New Harmony chickens are always on the grill. Manager Lo Kotzer says he buys Mulroy's chickens because they're simply the best.
All the feedback we get is very positive. The cooking times on the chicken is a bit longer because it's free range. But yeah, if you cook it for about an hour and a half, hour and 3/4, you get a very tasty meal.
Mulroy doesn't employ any laborers. The only help she gets is from her 2 young sons. The 3 live alone on the land. Risky in South Africa, where stock theft is rampant and criminals often murder farmers. But Mulroy insists she doesn't feel threatened.
Our biggest enemy on this property is a honey badger and wildcats, because that is a problem. We have to lock all the birds up at night because of the wildlife, not because of the human factor.
Another looming challenge for her business is the possible closure of a local abattoir.
The last time we had an abattoir here that was close by, when that abattoir closed down, 19 small farmers shut down as a result of that because they couldn't afford to go further away. In this country, I don't think that we are encouraged as small farmers to survive. Who's there to back us up? If something goes wrong, I'm screwed.
South Africa's government doesn't subsidize small food producers like in some other countries. Every year, many go bankrupt because of droughts and other factors, and food is lost to the country. But Ruth Mulroy says she's determined to continue producing top quality natural chicken without compromising her ethics. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Magaliesburg, South Africa.
In Kenya, a new IT platform is helping low-income earners get the kind of affordable health care once available only to the middle class and the affluent. Residents of Kibera, a vast slum in Nairobi, now have access to much-needed health care through their mobile devices. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi about the 10,000 Kibera residents using the technology.
It's early in the morning in Kibera, and Winnie Manga is preparing to go to work. The mother of six has a tailoring business where she makes about $30 a month, barely enough to meet her basic needs. But a mobile device known as M-Tiba allows Manga to save a dollar a month for healthcare. She downloads an app on her phone that sets up a savings account she uses to pay her health costs. She says this has enabled her family to get medical treatment that was once viewed as a luxury.
It helps a lot in the local health facilities around here, but in big hospitals, the charges are exorbitant and one can't afford it. When my grandson was sick, I would have been charged quite a lot, but since I had been saving for a while, I got the medicines at a reduced price, and they were quality drugs, too.
The so-called M-Tiba Mobile Health Wallet allows registered users to save money for healthcare services at various registered clinics for an affordable cost. Dr. Stanley Simiu has been treating patients at his clinic for 4 years. He says since the adoption of the platform, more Kibera residents are coming to the clinic, though he acknowledges there are some limitations.
Sometimes patients will come and they don't have enough money in the wallet, and that calls for a top-up for them. And also, some of the patients could walk in and they're not able actually to use the cell phone well. So you have to get in and start training them again on how to.
M-Tiba partnered with CarePay and PharmAccess to develop the health wallet. And so far, 10,000 people are using the technology. Kees van Led of M-Tiba says access to healthcare is a right for all.
We want to make healthcare truly inclusive for all Kenyans. Right now in Kenya, only 2% of the population has comprehensive health insurance. More than 1 million Kenyans end up in poverty every year because of health-related expenses, and we want to stop that.
Some 2,000 health facilities nationwide have signed on to M-Tiba's Health Wallet program. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to worsening drought conditions and increased food insecurity, the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, announced on January 19th an additional $5 million contribution to the United Nations World Food Program, or WFP, for humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe. This brings total U.S. government funding for humanitarian assistance to Zimbabwe to $32.5 million since June 2015, following a poor harvest across the country. According to the Zimbabwe Vulnerability Assessment Committee, an estimated 1.5 million rural Zimbabweans will face serious food shortages in the first 3 months of this year. This figure is likely to increase if El Nino, as predicted, causes continued drought and a poor April-June 2016 harvest. USAID's additional $5 million contribution will support WFP's productive asset creation activity starting in May 2016 and will provide food rations or cash transfers to over 80,000 individuals in 8 districts across Zimbabwe over a 6-month period. In exchange for the food rations or cash transfers, beneficiaries will participate in the creation or rehabilitation of community assets, including irrigation systems and dams, to improve infrastructure and livelihoods for the future. With total contributions of $32.5 million, USAID is working with its implementing partners, World Food Program, World Vision, and Cultivating New Frontiers in Agriculture, to scale up food security programs across 10 districts in Manicaland, Masvingo, and Matabele Land, north and south, reaching 450,000 people with humanitarian assistance. For more than 30 years, the American people, through USAID, have invested over $2.6 billion in Zimbabwe. Current projects include initiatives to increase food security, support economic resilience, improve health systems and services, and advance a more democratic system of governance. USAID is proud to support the World Food Program and help vulnerable Zimbabweans cope through this difficult drought, said USAID Mission Director Stephanie Funk. This program addresses immediate food security needs while gradually helping vulnerable communities build resilience to climatic shocks and eliminating the need for food assistance in the long term.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk. Traditional music. Are you a big fan? Does it bring good memories to you? Who is your favorite traditional music artist? Join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing traditional music. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.